Hello, hello, and welcome to another one of our Raise Expert interviews. Today, we have an awesome person. Her name is Dr. Vivian Chen. She is so, so cool. I'll tell you why she's so cool, you guys. She has a child with food allergies, and she's a doctor. I mean, how often is it that we meet someone in the medical field where it's like, they walk it, they live the life, they get it, and they're a doctor? So it's like, it's the best of both worlds. So thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Vivian.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here. I really admire your work, and I think you're doing an awesome job helping the allergy community. So this is just an absolute pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. I feel the same way about you. I love the information that you share online with people, and I love your commitment and dedication to health and well-being. And I feel like we need more of that. Like, we need more of the two worlds to come together, because they do work together. You know, the human body, it's not like this standalone unit where, oh, you have an allergy and that's it. It's like, no, there's something deeper, and you need to dig deeper, and you need to make sure that you're taking care of yourself, and that you're, you know, fueling yourself properly and getting what your body really needs, you know, especially when you have to eliminate a food group. Then you have to work a little bit harder to make sure you're getting all those nutrients. And in some cases, you should be supplementing as well. You know, so I think it's really cool that you have this wealth of knowledge. In fact, before we go further, how can people follow you and get all sorts of helpful information? How can our listeners do that?
So I'm on Instagram and Facebook. On Instagram, my handle is plateful.health. So that's plateful.health. H-E-A-L-T-H. And my Facebook handle is basically the same, but without the dot. So Plateful Health in one word.
Okay.
I also have a website. I actually have two websites. So for your listeners, probably the more relevant one would be the allergy one. So that's www.allergyfamilies.com. And then for my kind of more general health one, it's www.platefulhealthallinoneword.com.
All right. So there you have it. Dr. Vivian is Plateful Health. And so we're going to jump in. We had a couple of questions from our RAISE members. Mm-hmm. And the first one, and I think this is because a few of our members are a little bit familiar with what you do. And, you know, I shared with them that you are a healthy living doctor person.
I try.
I think you don't just try, you succeed. I mean, let's not forget, you made that vegan bacon that one time. I was like, man, he is rocking this.
Well, you make me salivate every day with your food. So the feeling is very much mutual.
But, you know, here's the difference. I post pictures of cake and candy bars. You're posting salads.
But hey, you're posting, let's be real, right? You know, we all need treats.
Oh,
okay. So, and you know, I live by the 80-20 rule, so I'm not perfect either. And I think life is too short to be so strict with yourself and deny yourself of pleasures. So you give me the eye candy that I need and aspire to, and you know, your recipes are healthy. Like, you know, they're allergy friendly. They're usually refined sugar free. So, you know, I love it. I love all your stuff.
I will say that's our thing. Like, I feel like you can have your cake and eat it too. And you can totally use better for you ingredients. Like, you're going to eat cake, but just without so much junk in it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Without damaging your gut lining and compromising your gut microbiome. So
that's way cool. Basically, I just need to tune into your 20 a little bit more.
Yeah.
I need to see more of that 20. All right. So first question, because we're talking about dessert. Mm-hmm. Someone asked, I'm trying to reduce the amount of added sugar in my child's diet. Any good tips? So do you have any good
tips? Yeah. So let's talk about sweeteners, first of all. So we know that refined sugar, and of course, if you're asking this question, you know that it can damage the microbiota in our gut. So that's the bacteria, the fungi, the viruses that live in the gut. And what sugar does is that it promotes the growth of certain strains, perhaps the more unhealthy strains. And what you end up with is a situation called dysbiosis. And we know that if there's dysbiosis in the gut, this then can compromise the gut lining. and then leaky, well, we call it in common terms leaky gut, but the medical term is intestinal permeability. And in my opinion, that's actually the root cause of allergies. So I think it's a great, first of all, to commend this listener for actually taking the time and effort to do that step to remove refined sugar, because I think that is actually very important in allergy sufferers. So there's another thing that I want to mention, which is that sweeteners like aspartame, sucralose, they actually have been shown to disturb the microbiome as well. So it's not just sugar. And it's been linked to hyperactivity and, you know, nervous system dysfunction. So I think the important thing to note is that sometimes sweeteners or alternatives are not what they seem like they are. So what I prefer is actually to sweeten, and you feel free to chime in because you're the much more of a recipe developer than me, but I actually prefer to firstly to use whole foods type of sweetener. So I actually make a date paste. So I soak pitted dates in hot water, and then I will blend that up in a high speed blender. And I do that with dried apricots and dried figs as well. They sweeten things up very nicely. And then I will use that to sweeten, you know, baking or my desserts. I make hot cocoa with that as well, actually. So blend it up, dates, that's a good way. And then brown bananas, that's like nature's sugar, right? So but except that it comes with fiber, so that's going to delay the sugar spike in your blood. So brown banana, and there's also options like stevia, monk fruit extracts. So stevia, we don't know whether it has any impact on the microbiome yet, but we know that it doesn't spike your blood sugar. And so it's like a low GI sweetener option. I think that in high doses, I've read some studies saying that it can have contraceptive effects, but I think you have to absolutely eat tons of it for that effect.
Got it, yeah.
And the other thing to mention is that our taste buds are part of the digestive tract. So if you taste something sweet, you're sending a signal to the brain to expect a blood sugar rise in your bloodstream. And so your pancreas is going to start secreting digestive enzymes and hormones. Now, if you take something like stevia, and I'm not against stevia, I think used in moderation and small quantities is absolutely fine. But I just wonder whether if you're taking in stevia and your body's expecting that sugar rise and you're not meeting it, then you know, that deficit there may drive you then to want something else. So then you end up kind of going for like the piece of chocolate anyway. I don't know. But yeah. I've read that happens to some people. So that's something to be aware of. And monk fruit extract is also a good option. Some people use xylitol, erythritol, but I have read that some people may be sensitive and get digestive issues like bloating. So just be careful with that.
Yeah. So I'm aware of a lot of those issues that you've shared. In our home, what's interesting is we stick to either organic cane sugar, mm-hmm. dark and light and raw cane sugars as well. We have done the date route, but we generally will use maple. And the mm-hmm. biggest reason why is the corn allergy. So because mm-hmm. I'm a severe corn allergic, we don't mm-hmm. experiment with things like monk fruit. We don't use erythritol, anything that can be corn derived. We don't use any of those sweeteners. And then of course, we don't use any artificial sweeteners. So things like aspartame, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then honestly, I'm on the fence with stevia. I think it's, I don't know, maybe a little out there for me. I would rather our kid have maple than stevia just because it takes a lot of stevia to like do the extraction process. And it just seems sometimes, you know, same thing with like agave. Mm-hmm. I had learned at one point that while we may feel that agave is this great idea, this great option, the truth is the amount of processing required to get it from the plant to the bottle. It's a lot of processing.
Yes.
Versus maple, which is like, turn on the tap, hit the sap, boil it, you're done. It's really straightforward. And I would personally, I feel more comfortable giving our kids something that's just a lot simpler, a little bit closer to nature. But that's me. And then of course, you know, we don't use coconut because Carlton has a coconut allergy. So for us, a lot of the alternative sweeteners are just off the table right off the bat.
Yes.
Because
yes,
for me,
you
to
mentioned
work with
some
it safely,
very good alternatives.
It's like, but you know, I feel like maple is the one universal, and so are dates.
Yeah. What about molasses?
We use that for like gingerbread, but beyond that, we don't use it mainly because the kids
has a strange taste, right?
It's so pungent that the kids are like, "Ugh, I'm good." Mm. Like of everyone, I think of our four standard eaters in the house, only one person genuinely enjoys molasses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm with you on that one. But I mean, I do use it from time to time as well. And you raise some great points. I think stevia, if you're buying the white powder, you know that that's been heavily.
Yeah, right? And that's what I'm referring to, really. It's like, you know, if you take a stevia plant, cut it up, you know, and literally blend it in your smoothie, I say, awesome. Like, I'm totally on board with that. But that white powder, that freaks me out. Mm-hmm. Like, as someone who understands the food industry, I'm like, what'd they do?
Why is it white when the plant is green?
Yes.
And also, agave is actually, I think, higher fructose content than high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, it's something crazy like that.
Some brands. So I definitely don't think that's would be a sweetener of choice in my household, but you mentioned some great alternatives there. So
now, have you experimented
for me?
Have you experimented personally with date syrup? I know you like to use dates. Have you ever used it?
I haven't, you know, just because I don't know. I don't tend to like syrups personally, like brown rice syrup, and just because it's, again, the extraction, you're concentrating the sugar content. It definitely does spike sugar level in your bloodstream and insulin spike. So date paste, the reason why I like it is because it still comes with that fiber, right? It is.
Right.
But I think it's more whole foods and less concentrated. I think anytime you try to hit your body with something that's extracted and fully concentrated, something else happens, in my opinion.
I think that's a very valid point. You know, we see a lot of syrups on the market, and I think you've really pegged it. It's like, the more we can give our bodies food the way nature intended, it's just better for us overall. So I can totally see where you're going with that, you know. But let's be honest, syrups are convenient. That's why people like them.
And you know, and going back to the 80-20 rule, you know, at the weekends I do sometimes pour a little bit of syrup on the pancakes, and you know, I think it's just your overall diet, right? A little bit of I don't even know what word, I don't want to demonize it, but you know, a little bit of something that's perhaps not so healthy is not going to break the camel's back. It's just whatever else you're eating, right? That 80% is what counts. Yeah.
Well, I think too, finding like easy hacks, like, so we've got a low, no sugar kid in our house, and as silly as this sounds, whipped cream, it has been a lifesaver in our house. You can get organic whipped cream. There's less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. It's basically just literally heavy whipping cream in the can, whipped up. Okay. The kids eat it like it's candy. They think they've gotten a treat. There's no sugar in it, and they're so happy with it. You know, it's like the little the little joys that we can provide them with, you know. Or, you know, take an apple, add some plain yogurt, put sprinkles on it. All of a sudden, your kids got sprinkles, and they just think, wow, I got sprinkles. This is so great.
This is why I love your work, because you do think of those ways that are so ingenious for introducing
it's letting them think they've had something awesome, but the reality is they've just had an apple with plain yogurt and a little bit of sprinkles. Like
I do that with lollies, like, so ice pops, you know. I've just literally like blended up a banana with some avocado and then called it ice cream, and they're like, wow, we're getting ice cream, and there's zero refined sugar in
that. I used to do that when the kids were little,
full of good fats.
We would make tropical smoothies, And then I would serve it in like a low, no sugar ice cream cone. And they would just, they were all like, oh, we got ice cream cones. Oh, it's Friday. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, haha, you just had a fruit smoothie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. See, like that's
So there's all those fun ways to just let them think, you know. And my whole thing, you know, like you said, the 80-20, an easy way to jazz up a fruit smoothie or even a green smoothie, drizzle some melted chocolate on top. And now they think they've got a real treat. Okay, you just gave them a green smoothie with a few chocolate chips, call it a mint chip smoothie or whatever you want to do, you know? And now you've got your kid, you know, enjoying healthy, better for them ingredients. And it's all those little ways, I think, that we can just
I love it.
Help them feel good about the food that they're eating.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So our next question would be, and this one really speaks to your mission. What are the chances a child will outgrow a food allergy? Are there any factors at work? And is there something that can be done to increase the chance? So maybe this is where you can share a little bit of your story with our listeners.
Yes. Okay, sure. So do you actually want me to go to the beginning of how it began, or how much time do we have?
Right. How much time do we have? Share as much as you're comfortable with sharing for our listeners. And listeners, you guys are in for a real treat. So hopefully you're able to just hang on and just keep listening. Like, go for a jog while you listen.
Okay, so I, as you mentioned earlier, I'm an MD. So I was trained in the UK. I'm conventionally trained, and I actually did some rotations in internal medicine. I was boarded in internal medicine in the UK. And then, so I rotated through dermatology, cardiology, a few other specialties. And then I decided I wanted to do family medicine. So I switched over to family medicine because I like that holistic kind of approach to medicine. So I like looking at the person as a whole rather than here's the liver patient, here's the here's the heart patient, here's the gallbladder patient. This is how, you know, we were trained in internal medicine. You know, we just focus on one organ, but actually all our organs impact each other, and even our brain can impact our organs. So that's what I enjoyed doing, and I switched over to family medicine. And then a couple of years later, I had my first child. And that's when my whole world turned upside down. And so what happened was, from about 3 to 4 weeks of age, she started to not feed properly. I was breastfeeding her. And she would just kind of start coming off the breast after a couple of minutes. And then, she, you know, looked like she was in pain and start crying. I tried a few things. I thought it may be the latch, you know, could it be the flow? Or I just tried so many different things suggested to me by the lactation specialist, and nothing worked. So I eventually took her to my doctor, who, based on the symptom of, you know, looking like she was in pain, arching her back and not wanting to feed, she said, oh, well, she probably has reflux. So let's try her on these medications, and prescribed her antacid medications. And when the initial antacid didn't work, they prescribed another one. So eventually she was on maximum dose, two different antacids, nothing worked. And things got so bad that she actually completely stopped feeding. She was 8 weeks, and she wasn't feeding. She got dehydrated, and she had to be admitted so that she could be tube fed. So she had a tube passed through her nose into her stomach, and she was being fed that way. I was still pumping then, and the milk was going down through the tube. But even then, literally by that point, I had seen, I think, 5-6 different doctors. You know, even myself, I didn't realize what was going on. And what was going on was she was allergic to cow's milk protein that was passed through my breast milk, and it was causing a reaction in her gullet. Inflammation in the gullet, so that every time she fed, she was in pain. She was labeled with lots of different things. So at one point, I think even a pediatrician was saying that she had behavioral disorder. Like, that just kind of completely blew me. And that was the point at which I was kind of like, okay, I went into medicine because I want to help people. And now I'm a mom. I can't help my own child. Something is not stacking up here. Like, this just turned my world upside down. I started doing research on the internet. I was just kind of reading whenever, you know, she's sleeping, I'm on the internet. I'm researching what's going on, what her symptoms represented. And eventually I came through research, research papers from, I think, 1980s, basically matching her symptoms to cow's milk protein allergy. And at that point, I suggested to her pediatrician, hey, I think this is what's going on. They thought I was mad, but because they didn't have a clue, well, they didn't have any solutions for us, they agreed to try this hypoallergenic formula. It's called Neocate. And literally after about a week of putting Neocate down the tube, she was better. And they were able to take the tube out. And she was actually feeding herself. So that basically established a diagnosis of cow's protein milk allergy, cow's milk protein allergy, rather. And later on, we would find out that she actually had allergies also to peanuts, egg, and wheat. Luckily, through the years, she outgrew those allergies. And then I had my second child who ended up with 10 allergies. I'm not going to go into the stories there, but I mean, because I was on the lookout, his diagnosis was way easier to make. So that's my journey. And the reason why I have a blog, the Allergy Families blog, is because it was so difficult to make that diagnosis. And then when I went back to practice, I realized how many people were actually silently suffering that I never recognized before I had that experience. You know, how many people I kind of poo-pooed off as having colic, or this is just normal, or you just have a fussy kid, pie baby, a baby who doesn't sleep. That's just normal. And none of it's normal. You know, there's always a reason. I'm not saying that in every case that it's going to be a food allergy, but I think it needs to be considered and the diagnosis ruled out before anybody jumps down the road of, hey, it's reflux. Let's put your child on maximum dose medication. And I'm not against medication. I'm a conventionally trained MD. Like, I use medication and I think there's a place for it. But not before you've properly made a diagnosis. And I think currently a lot of it's being used just kind of as a band-aid without very much thought. And that's why I decided to blog and share information, raise awareness, and I actually did a podcast with a radio station, because there's so many moms who are silently suffering, and I think that they would just, you know, if they could just know that it's not normal, they don't have to accept it and there's options, it would just bring some hope to them. So that's my mission.
That is an amazing mission, and I have to tell you, you know, you're preaching to the choir. Everything you're saying, it's like, I've been there, I know that feeling. You know, it's interesting because I was that kid. As a kid, I was the kid that written off as, it's normal, or it's not this, or your kid's just this, or, you know. And so on the flip side, when one of our kids had a problem, I was like, no, it's not normal. I know this from personal experience.
Right.
We have to figure this out right now, you know. Yep. And it's so refreshing, I think. And I would think it would be so cool if you, as an MD with this experience, can then go on to teach other MDs, you know. This is what we need to be looking at.
I try.
And this is what, you know, these people are feeling. And it's really important that we at least look at these things. And it's like you said, you know, I agree with you. I believe that there is a time and a place for Western medicine, but I also mm-hmm. believe there's a time and a place to figure out what's really going on first.
Yeah.
And making sure that we're not just mislabeling someone.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
For me, it's like I was 450 pounds and I was completely mislabeled. And it took almost dying for them to finally realize, oh, you're allergic to everything, you know? And it's right. like, okay, now we have the real reason that all yes. these other things were happening. It's like, no, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not this other thing. I'm not a million things. I'm just this one thing. And if you eliminate this one problem, everything else pretty much goes away, you know? And so yeah. I think that, you know, it's like you said, that maybe they're not used to seeing it and they just don't know that, you know, there are these things out there. And, you know, I get it. It's like doctors, they have to go through so much training and a yes. lot of information is thrown at you guys.
Yep.
And so I think it can be really hard, you know, when you're so used to looking at, well, is it this thing and this thing and this thing? You know, it's easy to kind of overlook, what about a food allergy?
You know, well, I think that the thing to say there is also that food allergies is a fairly recent phenomena. So I think it was first, hay fever was first described in the 1800s. And then we've just seen an absolute epidemic in the last, you know, 100. Well, I think that real rise has been the last 10, 20 years, right? But yeah. I mean, as a disease or a condition, it's only been around or described for the last, what, 150 years?
Yeah.
So it's not something I think that people really have studied that much, have that much experience with. And certainly at medical school, I was taught about the anaphylaxis type allergy, which is IgE mediated, as you know. Nothing, absolutely nothing about delay type allergy and the manifestations. So, you know, the fact that it could cause migraine, for example, was complete news to me. And, you know, during my research on, you know, trying to help my daughter, I realized that there were rheumatoid arthritis patients whose symptoms went away. So their rheumatoid arthritis was treated just by eliminating dairy. So, you know, how an allergy can cause joint destruction to that extent and nobody knows. And they're like, you know, being put on cytotoxic medications, immunosuppressants.
Yes.
But the thing is, medical education, I think, lags behind the research. So, you know, for medical research, firstly, medical research can be biased. And secondly, by the time it makes it into a doctor's practice, I think it's, you know, something like 10, 20 years after publication. And then for it to make it into medical education is another, I don't know how many years. So you can see the delay there. So I would definitely say, trust your instinct. You really are your best own doctor. You are the best doctor. You know your body well. And for moms, you know your child, you know the scream, you know the cries. They just sound different to, you know, oh, I'm hungry, my nappy is wet type of crying. You know, if they're in discomfort, they're screaming, you know. And just don't, I think don't give up and don't stop looking for an answer.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the arthritis because for me, and Carlton is convinced that we should donate my body to science one day. it's interesting because certain foods cause very specific reactions. I actually have over 200 different symptoms related to food allergies and food intolerances, one of which is dates specifically cause my left knee so much pain, but only the left knee, not the right knee. And oftentimes it's funny because I'll forget because it's not like a life-threatening allergy and I'll eat a date or two, like, you know, once a year or once every few months. And then, you know, it's difficult to walk and I'm like, oh man, my knee is killing me. And I'm like, what on earth? And then I'll be like, oh yeah, I ate some dates.
yeah, that's right.
And that's literally what it's like. So it's like, you know, to say arthritis pains or even like things like gout, you know, or, you know, migraine, whatever. All of it can be related. And in some cases,
fatigue,
it's not fatigue. Related, you know.
Fatigue is a big one for adults. actually. Well,
and if you think about it, your body is exhausted. It's exhausting trying to process fight what it can't do. You know, it really is exhausting.
Yes.
Completely exhausting. Yeah.
And I think to talk about outgrowing allergies, we have to look at what's causing it first, right? Because if you want to talk about how we can help our children outgrow allergies, we need to know what's causing it to then be able to remedy those things that are in place that's causing allergies. So do you think should we go into that a little bit before I answer
Absolutely.
The question?
I think we should preface it with this, however. No two people are the same. So for those of you guys who are listening, you know, please don't take this as the end all, like every child will outgrow allergies. That's not what this is. Can some people outgrow it? Absolutely. Can some people stick with it their whole life? Absolutely. You know, no two people are the same. Always remember that. Keep your food journal, you know, stay on top of things. Just because it worked for Dr. Vivian and her kids doesn't mean it'll work for me and my kids. Mm-hmm. And it's really important. Like, should you be hopeful? Well, sure. Depending on your kid's situation, it really could work. But also know that other factors are in play, even things like ethnicity, genetics.
Oh, yes.
You know, all of that comes into play when you're talking about outgrowing. And are we dealing with food allergies or food intolerances? You know, were they a C-section baby? You know, how were they formula fed? It's like there are all these different things. And it is so important to remember this as well. It doesn't happen overnight.
Oh,
yes. Your child outgrows an allergy, because Dr. Vivian's about to tell us this great story, because I've heard it and I love it. And the thing is, please don't think that your child outgrows it literally overnight. It's very, very, very rare that that happens, that it's an overnight process.
But I've never seen it overnight.
The method that Dr. Vivian is going to be talking about, it's, you know, a process that takes several years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's prepping the body for this change, essentially. So I wanted to preface it with that before we continue, just because I don't want people to be misled. Like, all right, Dr. Vivian's going to give us the magic pill.
There is no magic pill. I wish I had the magic pill. But yeah, I mean, the data shows, I think it was a recent study that showed that depending on the allergen, right? And as you said, everyone's different, because depending on the allergen, the rate of outgrowing is different. So for example, milk and egg is so much more common, so much easier for people to outgrow than something like peanut or shellfish. So I think the rate of outgrowing depends on the food itself. And if you have multiple allergies, I think the rate goes down, because that suggests something in your genetics or in the internal terrain of your body that is pushing the immune system more towards the allergenic side. What we call the Th2 arm, which is the side that kind of promotes an allergic reaction to foreign materials. So, but the hopeful part of that is that around 40% of children with milk or egg allergy will outgrow it. So that's, I think that's great, because that's quite a high figure, but then, you know, there is still the 60% who don't. And like you said, it could be down to the genetic. And I think with any chronic disease, there's never just one cause, right? So you can't just be doing one thing and expect a change in your body. There's a multi-pronged approach is needed, because in allergy, in my opinion, it's a genetic predisposition, because, you know, lots of people have leaky gut, they don't have allergies. Why is that? Well, because their genes predispose them to that. You need, it's kind of almost like you need that perfect storm, but then the storm is getting more and more frequent these days, and we need to look at what we can do to come maybe overcome that a little bit. Because yes, we can't do anything about genes, but we can certainly, you know, make changes that may then change the factors that could contribute. So for example, my own children, my daughter outgrew her allergies, but my son, he went from 10 allergies down to, he's now allergic to peanuts, walnuts, and pecans. Okay, so we're now down to the allergy that's, you know, less likely to be outgrown. But I'm still trying. And like you said, it's not overnight. It's kind of years, actually years of every day being persistent and working on the same things day in day and not knowing what will happen, but just remaining hopeful. That kind of, I think that's the key here. So if we're going to look at why is there such an epidemic of allergies, and you know, if we're talking about food allergies, the incidence I think has gone up 50% in the last 10-15 years.
Yeah, what the number that kills me every time, and I share this with people from time to time, it's like if you look at 1997, that was the year. Mm-hmm. When they show the charts, that's the year where the big spike happened. And 1997 was also the year that they allowed companies like Monsanto to start releasing GMOs to like the general public. And so I often tell people it's not just a genetic thing. It's an environmental. It's what are you eating? Oh, yeah. What have you been fed? Mm-hmm. What are you drinking? Yes. What are you breathing? It all works together. And it's like you said, it's that perfect storm. Because, you know, for people like myself that have really, we are the exception, not the rule. You know, we are the canary in the coal mine, right? You know, you can send a group of people down to the coal mine and only one might die because the rest of them were a little bit stronger or a little bit this, you know, and that's what's happening, in my opinion, in the food allergy world. It's like, yeah, we're seeing all these problems, but we're mostly seeing it in, you know, children and those with weakened immunity, et cetera. It's like the weaker of the group, essentially, are showing everyone else, hey, there's a problem. And eventually you're going to have this problem too if we don't, as a society, fix whatever the root cause is.
Yes, 100%. Just can't agree with that more. Beautifully said. And I think that if we're going to stand back and look at why there's an epidemic, just look at the state of the planet, right? You know, our planet is so unhealthy now. How can we be healthy when our planet is so unhealthy? Because there's a symbiosis between us and, you know, the world that we live in. We need to get our microbiome, for example, from the outside world. But if that outside world microbiome, so I'm talking about bacteria in soil, for example, you know, every time you take a walk in nature, you're breathing in bugs that then populate your gut. But what if those bugs are not there anymore because of the pollution and what we're doing? So I think that it is definitely a gradual process. But yes, 1997, for sure, we saw a marked rise in all these chronic diseases. And I think Monsanto and glyphosate literally is kind of like the tip of the iceberg, because there's 85,000 man-made chemicals in our environment.
Yeah.
All of those are interacting together in our bodies. And what it's doing is that it's weakening or pushing our immune system, because don't forget, our bodies never mess up. That's what I say. Our bodies never mess up, because these allergic reactions, most of the symptoms is to alert you and also to push out something that your body doesn't like.
Yes.
And we're putting things, so, you know, if you ate poison or something, you know, your body's going to react by vomiting, you know, it's going to try and push it out. And that's a lot of the allergic symptoms are the body trying to get rid of something it doesn't like. So it's saying, hey, you're putting something in me that I don't like. Can you please get rid of it? And we need to take heed. And there's a lot of kind of data suggesting a link between car exhaust, so put car exhaust pollution and asthma, allergies. So definitely what we're breathing, as you say, if there's, you know, chemicals and particulate matter that's damaging our microbiome in the nose, in the respiratory tract, in the gut, that's going to expose us to increased risk of allergies. In our house, there's so many chemicals that's bombarding our immune system too. You know, what you put on the skin, creams, if your child has eczema, the creams? Is it, does it contain chemicals that could be upsetting the immune system? And also the food, and that has a direct relationship on our microbiome in the gut. And we know that 70% of our immune system is in the gut. And that's kind of the first place where, well, the gut and the skin is basically where our body senses allergens, right? First time it meets anything. And, you know, there's like the theory of leaky skin syndrome. So if you have eczema, you're more likely to develop food allergies. They're saying because you're actually exposed to allergens through the skin. So we've lost tolerance in our immune system. Our immune system is kind of overreacting and, you know, on guard and a little bit confused as to what's friend, what's foe. So the principles of trying to help is to kind of dampen down that immune, well, not dampen down the immune, but redirect it. You know, so there's not that imbalance between TH1, TH2, and then, you know, trying to rebuild a gut is always one of the top tips that I give everybody, because if you have a gut membrane that's leaky, your immune system is on hyper alert. And also trying to reduce, so we talk about indoor pollution, so the chemicals in our household, VOCs, off-gassing from furniture, for example, the carpet.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a link between that and asthma as well. And it's not just allergy we're seeing epidemic, right? I mean, eczema has doubled in 10 years.
Wow.
And asthma has gone up 30%. So our bodies are complaining. We need to do something. So those are, so, I mean, I want to say that we don't blame yourself, because that's what I did. I blamed myself when my daughter got the diagnosis. I was like, well, why didn't you do this, do that? And, you know, you could have prevented it. No, that, I think that, that firstly, it doesn't do anything. Like, it doesn't change anything. And secondly, we don't know. And, you know, it's the agency that we're expecting to protect us aren't there to protect us and educate us. So yeah. We don't know. And how can you change something that you didn't know? But I think once you know, then you can take steps, right? And
yes.
We're not aiming for perfection. I can't move house just because I live, you know, my urbanization, we have to live in the city, like we have jobs, we can't just go move into the forest. But just taking steps where you can and knowing that you're doing your best, that's what I aim for.
Yeah, no, everything you said is so on point. And, you know, going back to even just taking a walk outdoors, you know, I often tell people, when you look at the westernized world versus, you know, a jungle in the middle of nowhere, they don't have the rate of food allergies and mental health disorders exactly. Like we do. Yes, they have mm-hmm. weird diseases like, you know, measles, but mm-hmm. they don't have everything else, which tells you if we're all humans, if we're all basically the same, it only comes down to three things: air, water, and food. That's mm-hmm. really the big difference, you know. And then, like you said, 85,000 chemicals, that's a lot for the human body to try to process and learn and figure out, you know. And mm-hmm. the thing about that, and someone brought this to my attention once, and I was just like, my mind was blown, but it made mm-hmm. so much sense. They don't test for what if. When a mm-hmm. chemical company creates something, when they are supposedly approved by the FDA as safe or generally regarded as safe, they're not required to show what happens when our chemical interacts with all the other chemicals on the market.
Oh, yes.
And so, you know, no one knows what happens when you start, you know, tacking them all together. Exactly. And we as a society are essentially the largest non-voluntary experimental project mm-hmm. in the history of all humankind.
Yes.
We are just one giant guinea pig at this point.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're learning, or at least I'd like to think we're learning, it doesn't work. And yet at the same time, people are so connected and addicted and desire these conveniences that perhaps we won't make progress with, you know, my generation and your generation, you know, our generation, we're set, but perhaps we can help the next generation.
Exactly.
Say, okay, look, don't bring all these chemicals into your home. These are better. This is a better way to live, you know, and, you know, go outside, you know, in a non-polluted area and take a walk 20 minutes a day, you know, and maybe help them and then the next generation after. But
yes,
everything you said, it's so on point and it just totally resonates.
Yeah. And I think when you see things like the EWG study that showed cord blood containing 243 chemicals.
Yeah.
It really hits home, right?
That
I think that we need to wake up. It's not woo-woo. It's not conspiracy theory. I'm far from conspiracy theorist. I've been taught to read science and I, you know, stand behind science. I don't like to tout things unless there's good research behind it. And there's now very good research. It's just that it's not widely available. It's not promoted. And so, you know, if you are listening to this and you know, and this resonates, please share the message. You know, you, when you talk to your friends, they may not like it the first time you say it, but really come from it, from a viewpoint that you're trying to help. And the more we spread this message, I think the more change can happen, because we need to, you know, we vote with our dollar, right?
And we do. Yes.
And we need to support businesses that are doing the right thing, providing, you know, chemical-free products for us to use. You know, not spraying on their crops and you know, trying to provide clean food for us. We want those businesses to survive. So anything that you can do, even just to buy, support those businesses, I think is helping this movement.
Yeah. Well, and another little thing, you know, that I think people overlook as well, it's even your clothes. You know, for myself personally, you know, organic socks, you know, organic shirts. It's like things that are on my body, you know, maybe not all my sweaters are organic, but my t-shirts are. You know, if it's directly in contact with me,
yes,
it's like,
and always wash off your clothes the first time.
Oh, I know.
Like, I know people who don't wash the clothes, right? They buy it, they're like, oh, it's new, I'm just gonna wear it. And there's so many
chemicals. I cringe so hard when I see that. I'm like, no, please wash it. Please wash it. Yeah. No, I'm with
you. Do you react to non-organic cotton, just out of interest?
In some cases, yes. Sometimes I have to wash things a few times before I can wear it safely without it irritating me. Other times, just one wash. Organic, I'm fine. Non-organic, it really just depends. And I think it, you know, it's the processing. It's, you know, sometimes clothes are like, where if they're made out of country, they're sprayed before they're sent over.
Right.
And so sometimes it's literally just that spray. So it may not have been the clothing itself, but then how it was treated after the fact. And so you have a lot of that, and only because I'm aware of it am I, like, you know, always telling our kids, no, wash that first. You know, it's like, you can't wear that. We just bought it.
Yeah. And the chemicals from that can actually start causing inflammation in the respiratory tract. And then that sets off the immune system. Then it starts to activate the TH2 response and you start becoming more allergic and more kind of tendency towards allergies. Because don't forget, there's a lot of allergies in adults now. And I'm sure you're seeing that. So new allergies. And I used to, when I first qualified, I never saw adults developing allergies for the first time in their adulthood. So like, for example, they were never allergic to anything. And then suddenly they're allergic to shrimp. And then as I practiced more and more, I began to see more and more of that. And now I think it's really not uncommon. You know, the fruits, so the oral
allergy syndrome.
Yeah. So to fruits, stone fruits, and that's quite common. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, OAS, I feel, is a little easier to treat in that, you know, number one, if you can get the environmental allergens under control, it helps with reducing the OAS symptoms. But with OAS, oftentimes you can peel off the skin and then cook the fruit and then consume the cooked fruit flesh safely.
Yes. Yeah.
Which to me, it's like, you know, it's a few extra steps, but at least you don't have to give everything up necessarily. You know, it's so interesting how complex the situation is.
Yes.
You know, and it's fascinating. Complex. You know, it's sad that it's happening. And yet, you know, for me as someone that's always had a scientific mind, it's like, it's fascinating. And I see it as one giant experiment. And honestly, you know, it's funny. People always say to me, oh, you must love baking. And I'm like, oh no, I actually don't. I'm not a baker.
I know. Same here.
It's like,
wish there were things solver. I could buy, right?
Yeah. Like me, I'm a problem solver. I see the world as one giant problem. I see it as a problem that our kid can't eat, you know, X, Y, Z. And so to me, it's, I'm going to solve the problem. You know, I enjoy the process of solving the problem, but what people see on the outside is they think I enjoy the process of cooking. It's like, it's about solving a problem.
Yes,
and then, of course, making it look good and making it taste good, which are also problems, right?
Exactly.
So it's one giant problem.
Yeah.
And I wish it weren't there, but unfortunately, it's growing. And unless people really start to, like you said, take control of their health, once they know, we're just going to keep having this problem. Keep going.
Yes.
Keep going.
Yes, exactly. And I think the important thing to remember, and as you alluded to, is that there's so many factors. And so the commonest question I get asked is, so what probiotic do you recommend I take or I give to my child? And it's like, well, have you looked at what you're feeding your child first? Have you looked at the chemicals that could be in the food? Have you looked at the coloring, the preservatives? Have you looked at chemicals in your household? Have you cleaned up your household? Are you still using Clorox to clean, for example, you know, the VOCs from your furniture? All those things need to be done. So it's not kind of like, there really is no magic bullet. So, you know, if I give you just the probiotic recommendation, I feel like I'm doing you an injustice. I mean, it could be part of the solution, but it's only one small part.
Yes. And I love that you're taking that multifaceted approach to solving the problem, because you and I are both the same. It's like, there is no one thing. It's like, are you vitamin D deficient? Can we look at that? You know, what else are you deficient
so
on?
So much of that.
You know,
exactly.
Can we look at your gut flora? Can we look at all these imbalances? Let's fix those. Then let's look at adding something in, you know,
absolutely.
So it's so important.
Yeah.
Our next question is, as a doctor and food allergy mom, what's your feeling on OIT? So oral immunotherapy. Mm.
Wow. That's an interesting question, because my son actually just went through OIT. Well, not went through, we tried it for a few months. So I don't want to put it down. I think it works well. And definitely from a safety point of view, I can see why it may be important, because, you know, it takes that concern. As an allergy mom, I'm constantly living in fear, right? So the phone rings from school and I'm like, oh, is it a reaction? Has he eaten something? Okay. Like, you know, so if I could do something, and that's why I decided to try OIT with my son, because I didn't want to have that constant fear anymore. But again, we're coming back to Band-Aid. Like, am I just doing that one thing? You know, I am addressing all these things that, you know, working on his gut, trying to clean up, you know, our home environment, living clean. But if you're not doing all those things and you're just trying OIT, and we know that OIT is not permanent, right? Right. As of now anyway.
Yes.
So you constantly have to maintain that. And definitely I've looked after patients where they go off to college. They're not so diligent. They have a bug that makes them, you know, throw up, and they haven't taken their dose. And then the next thing you know, they're reacting and they're having anaphylaxis, because they've missed the dose a few times. So I'm not saying that happens to everybody. I'm just saying that I've looked after cases, and you know, it's not about how few cases there are. It's just that you don't want your kid to be one of those cases where you know, they're having reactions and you're not there to help them. So I think it can work really well. And they're definitely, you know, there's very hopeful drugs in trials right now. I think one is going through FDA right now, the A-Immune, I think it's called, where they actually put peanut protein into capsules and then you're just taking them by increasing increments. And that's been shown to be quite effective, actually. So would I try it again? Probably, yeah. But my son actually, it's a funny story. And I think this really goes to show how important our gut membrane is as a barrier to and as a contribution to allergy formation, because my son was having treatments for OIT for peanut and walnut allergies. He was doing really well, and then he started to have environmental allergies, so it's hay fever season. And and I wouldn't recommend doing that, but I did it because you know, I'm a doctor. I know how to treat anaphylaxis at home, but I was actually just testing him whether to see whether he could tolerate peanuts, and he was actually starting to tolerate peanuts. But that, so him eating some peanuts along with environmental allergies that were playing up, really ramped up his immune system. And so eventually he actually ended up with a reaction, and he had anaphylaxis in the doctor's office to one of his shots. And it was completely unexpected, because he was on the same dose that he was on the previous few weeks. He just reacted completely unexpectedly. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that, you know, it can have unexpected reactions. And if it works, it, you know, it depends on the condition. Like if you're, you know, is pollen season particularly bad this year, for example? Have you exercised? Are they, you know, are you sick? Those things can ramp up the immune system such that you may still react. So I definitely think it's a good option. Sorry, that was a very long-winded explanation, but I definitely think it's a valid option. I just think that you need to work also on the root causes and look at what's causing allergy in the first place.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I know for me personally, you know, people often ask me about OIT, and I tell them flat out, I love the idea of it. It's just not for us. Mm. Like for us, I feel like there's just too much at play. You know, I would never put myself through it. I would never put one of my kids through it, because it's like, it's just, I don't want to be that one person where it's like, they're going to have a problem, you know? And I know it's more than just the food allergies at play. I know that there's more. And it's like, even though we have reduced a lot of junk in our home, and, you know, we do this and we do that, you know, he still has environmental issues and this issue and that issue and these other issues. And it's like, you know what? I'm not going to add more stuff on that, you know? And, but at the same time, I get it. Some people don't want their child to breathe in peanut dust and die. Yes. I totally understand.
Exactly.
You know, I will say I get a little bit frustrated when people are like, oh yeah, I want my kid to do OIT so they can just eat normal food. It's like, are you hearing yourself? You know, I think you're overplaying what OIT does here, you know, but for the parents that just don't want their kid to die from peanut dust in the air, like those are the ones that I really sympathize for.
Yeah.
Like I think look that at and I say, okay, I get it, you know, but beyond that, I just, it's not for us. Like I don't, there's a safety level that I'm not willing to cross. And, you know, is our life convenient? Absolutely not. But it works for us, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the reason, right? If you're looking for OIT to cure allergy, I don't think it's a cure.
Yeah.
Is it an option to remove that, to put an added safety factor in? Yes, it is.
Yes.
It definitely, you know, if your child accidentally consumed peanut containing food, they're not going to have anaphylaxis and die. But it doesn't mean they can go out and just eat whatever they want, though.
Yeah. And I think there's a misconception among some people. And again, I think it really just depends on the parents and their background. And, you know, I see it more where it's literally the only kid in the house with an issue. You know, the parents are perfectly fine and they're eating non-traditional, like they're eating conventional food. They love their fast food. They love their this, you know, amongst that crowd is where I see it the most. They're looking for a cure rather than looking to just treat it like a medical condition and deal with it every single day. You know, and different strokes for different folks, I suppose. But yeah. All right. Our last question from our listeners. Any tips on navigating the medical world, specifically when doctors don't believe me or give me a look like I'm crazy when describing symptoms, etc.? And I'd like to say, you know, to our listeners, we have been so blessed as a family. I have never been looked at as crazy, and nor have, like when I'm dealing with the kids, you know, never been looked at as crazy. And mm-hmm. so we only ever experienced that, I don't want to use the word disbelief, but disbelief once, and it was pretty recent. Mm-hmm. Last May, I basically almost died in bed, and Carlton was like, oh, I don't know what to do. So after having a 4-hour allergic reaction, which was not just biphasic, but almost like triphasic, mm-hmm. He had called 911. And so, you know, EMTs come out and they basically refused to treat because there were no hives and my throat wasn't closed up. But every, mm-hmm. you know, there were multiple organs in play, multiple systems, mm-hmm. symptoms in play. And then they were like, we think it's just a panic attack. We were like, okay, mm-hmm. yeah, sure. We'll just accept whatever you're saying. And, you know, and that was the end of it. But that was the first time we'd ever experienced something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas we knew what was going on and everybody else just didn't, you know? And so mm-hmm. I guess I say all that just to say my heart breaks for people who share with us. Yeah. You know, we're on our third allergist and they still won't test for this or they won't do that. It's like, what? How is that even a thing? You know?
Yeah, I know. I'm just as frustrated as you. And I think it comes back to medical education. It's not in the curriculum. And certainly before I had my allergy journey, I probably would have looked at you and thought, what's going on here, right? Yeah. This is not what I was taught. There's no hives. You know, you're taught all of that. There's no drop in blood pressure. So it can't be possibly be an allergic reaction. But now knowing what I know, you know, I know kids who, it's not common, but one particular patient I'm thinking of, his allergy manifests as him going into like unarousable sleep. Mm. So if he eats nuts or egg, he literally just falls asleep and his parents cannot wake him up for like 4 to 6 hours. So similar to what you went through, but his allergist won't accept that as an allergy, but it's completely reproducible. Every time he does it, it happens to him. So, you know, and then I'm the only one who supported him because I know that it can do things, strange things like that. So how to navigate? I think most likely an allergist who's going to understand what's going on is someone maybe from a functional medicine background or who's kind of more integrative, who understands the role of nutrition. And it really is quite hard. I mean, I'm on a Facebook group that's basically, it's called Food Allergy Mom Who Are Physicians or something like that. So it's a group of physicians who have children with food allergies. And within that group, they're not talking about gut health.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and my own allergist does not recognize the role of gut health. And when I speak to him about probiotics, he's like, well, there's no evidence that it does anything. So, you know, I'm not a proponent. I'm not saying, yes, you should take probiotics. No, you shouldn't, because it actually really depends on what you're eating and your own terrain. But if they're just flat out refusing to recognize that allergy is more than just genetics and there's environmental things at play, then I think you need to look for someone else. And unfortunately, you do have to, like, you know, I went through so many allergists myself because I don't want to be looked after by someone who refuses to acknowledge all the things that I believe in. I don't know whether that's kind of, I think it's lack of education on their part. I mean, they work very hard and I think that they mean well, but if this data is not presented at these allergy meetings that they attend, they probably don't know.
Yeah. Well, unless they've experienced it firsthand like you, you're absolutely right. And so to them, it's like this whole new thing of what? No. That's not how the body works. And that's not what I've read. And like you said, that's not what I've been taught. And so I think in that case, you know, for listeners, when you're dealing with a doctor who doesn't believe you, especially if they don't believe you, right? Mm-hmm. If they're not willing to listen, that's when it's time to find a new doctor.
Yes.
You know, you are your own best advocate. And mm-hmm. you are the only advocate, honestly, for your child. Because yeah. for as good or as poor as a doctor may be, they will never be as invested in your child as you are. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a lot of other patients. They have their own lives. They have their own kids. You are the best advocate for your family. And so yeah. it's important that if people aren't helping you, you know, don't be rude about it. Just politely remove yourself from the situation until you can find someone who says, oh, I recognize the problem. And perhaps I don't have the solution, but I'm going to help you find the solution. Yeah, you know, even exactly. that, I don't think that's a bad doctor. I think that's one of the best kind of doctors. A doctor who can admit that they don't know the answer, but they believe mm-hmm. you and they want to help you. You know, that's great. That's half yeah. the battle right there. So, you know, that's what you're on the lookout for. Thank you so much, Dr. Vivian. We appreciate your time. I would love for you to share with our listeners, how can they book an appointment with you? I don't know if you guys know this about Dr. Vivian, but she does health coaching. So I would love for you to tell our listeners about that.
Oh, yeah. So thank you for that. And yeah, I absolutely enjoy this conversation with you and hope you guys found it helpful. If you want to book an appointment with me, you can just go to my website, the Plate for Health one, www.plateforhealth.com, and just email me from there. And do you provide links?
I can put a link in, of course.
So I can just link in my email address there so people can reach me directly as well.
Well, there you go. You guys now have a direct connection to the world-renowned Dr. Vivian. Hey, you've been in two countries, so that makes you world-renowned. Dr. Vivian, you are so amazing. And guys, we're going to post some links and just share what she does. Thank you so much for taking the time.
And you guys, please help us spread the message. Tell everybody about this wonderful platform, Raise, and help us raise awareness.
Yes, you get it. You absolutely get it. We're raising awareness. We are empowering people. You know, take back your health, take back your kitchen. You can do this. So again, thank you so much, Dr. Vivian. And thank you everyone for listening today. Have a safe and delicious week.